Welcome to JGL Law for You. This podcast is sponsored by Joseph Greenwald & Lake, a suburban Maryland law firm that has been representing clients throughout the D.C. metropolitan area and across the country for close to 50 years. JGL Law for You is a podcast by lawyers, but not for lawyers only. On JGL Law for You, we will bring you up close and personal with our lawyers and some special guests who will be discussing how to navigate the many legal processes, developments in the law, other current events, and how they may affect you, your family, or your business. Today, we're moving to the area of employment law, what every employee ought to know. And to walk us through all of this is Joseph Greenwald & Lake shareholder Brian Markovitz. Brian is a native Maryland resident, a 2000 graduate of Georgetown University Law Center, and a 1993 graduate of Dickinson College. He focuses his practice on labor and employment issues and the False Claims Act. Brian, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Well, let's sort of dig right in and talk about employees who are in different circumstances, right? First, I want to ask you a little bit about folks who actually have an employment contract. Tell me about you know, what they need, what they should look out for, and so forth.
Okay. So the first thing to know is if you have an employment contract, lots of people they're not aware, believe it or not, that they have a contract. They signed a lot of paperwork when they first started working there. You know, like many of us, when we get a bunch of papers put in front of us, they didn't read necessarily what they were signing. So they are unaware of that. So the first thing you should probably do is go down to Human Resources if you have an inkling that you might have a contract and find out if you do have one. If you do have a contract, then that will set up a lot of the way that your relationship with your employer will work. That would include your compensation, pay raises, what they could discipline or terminate you for. Those are sort of the things that are covered. Generally, if you have an employment contract, you can only be terminated for what's called for cause or for gross negligence. And and those terms are generally defined in the contract. For cause means they have to give a good reason, some sort of reason. They can't just let you go. Gross negligence is something worse than for cause. So, and that's often defined, or there's examples given in the contract. An example would be something such as theft or some sort of really bad incompetence that caused great financial harm to the company, or ethical or some sort of financial duty that was violated. And so those are the things to know if you have a contract. That's sort of the first thing to understand.
Let me ask you a little bit about the first mm-hmm. piece of that, the for cause. Mm-hmm. What does that mean exactly to the employee? I mean, can I be fired if the employer says, well, I just don't like where things are going, and therefore you're out. I'm going to replace you with somebody else, or I'm not going to replace you at all. Is that cause sufficient if I just don't really like you or don't really like your work product?
That is a good question. If they just didn't like you, then that would not be for cause generally. It's usually something the employee has to do very wrong. Now, if your work product, and that's a little more subjective, so that could be for cause, and that might lead to a court battle. You know, if they're saying, well, you're really not up to snuff, you're not doing what we want, you know, we like things this way, we tried to give you some examples, and you're still not meeting it, that might be for cause. That might be a good reason. And that would be something that a fact finder, I mean, that could go to a jury trial, for instance, that might actually make its way into court, and then a jury or a judge, depending on what the contract said, would have to decide if that for cause had been met.
Let's say you work for a company, you're part of a particular team, whatever we do. We sell, you know, rocket parts, pick whatever the heck it is. And mm-hmm. there's six or eight of us on this team. And I was hired to be on this team. And after 2 or 3 months, you know, I'm just not fitting in. I mean, people aren't really don't like me around. They don't feel like I mesh with the rest of the team, and I'm bringing sales down, or I'm causing other interpersonal conflict. Is that cause enough for management, for employer to say, you know, this is not working out, you got to go?
So generally that would be enough. If you're causing financial harm to the company, or you're causing some problems interpersonally with the team, that should be deemed for cause most of the time. Harming to the team is a little more subjective. You know, do you play well in the sandbox with others? That's a subjective, and that might lead to a court battle over whether that was for cause. That's a little more squishy, but financial harm is generally for cause.
All right. And let's talk about the gross negligence concept. What does that mean to me as an employee?
you can only be fired for gross negligence, you're in pretty good spot, because it's not just regular negligence, it's gross negligence, right? Which is a sort of a term of art. Often that's defined in these contracts. So they'll put specific examples to give you an idea of what that is. And it's usually, again, it's like a, it has to be something really, really, really extreme. You know, if you steal from the company, well, that's a really, that's gross negligence. That meets the bill. Let's say that you're the chief financial officer of the company, and you know, you don't file some forms properly at the SEC, and there's a big SEC investigation at the company. Well, that would be another example. You didn't uphold your financial duties. It's usually something that's within the core of your duties. Like, what are you there to do? And if you don't do that, then that would generally be gross negligence.
Right. Now, in terms of the employee population, you know, in this country, what's the percentage of folks, if you have any numbers along this lines, that actually have a written contract with their employer? How often do you see that?
It's pretty small. Most people that have the contract, they're pretty high up in the company. So it would be your upper level management. Those are the ones that generally have the contract. And so on occasion, those people do not know that they've had a contract, but most of the time they do. And those are usually, again, often those are negotiated by lawyers. So you might have a lawyer, because the person's so high up, they actually can afford to pay a lawyer by the hour, and they hire a lawyer and they work out the details. It's interesting because, you know, normally if you get let go from a job, that's it. You just separate and go your way, your own way. But if you have a contract, sometimes there'll be a severance package. People will get, you know, you hear the golden parachute. I'm sure people have heard that, probably said that's like a retirement or something when it's, you know, the CEO of Disney or somebody gets fired. Mm-hmm. And so those are governed by the contract.
Okay. Let's toggle over to folks. What about people who are union members, work in shops that are unionized?
Yeah. So unions, I think they make up about 12% of the workforce right now. It might be a little less than that. It's somewhere in that range. It's been declining over the years, although heard recently it actually took a little bit of an uptick, I think maybe because of COVID or some reason, but now it's—
Why do you think it's been declining, just out of curiosity?
It's a lot of things. There's certainly politics are involved. There's a lot of groups now that come out really hard against unions. The unions also, there's infighting amongst unions and union members. You know, people are often struggling to be in charge of the union, as opposed to, you know, their real enemy is, you know, is management. That's how the system is supposed to be set up. But they fight amongst themselves. It's sort of like the old adage when someone made that joke about the Democratic Party, when someone said, you know, I'm not a member of any organized party, I'm a Democrat. You could apply that to unions. You know, even though they're supposed to be organized, they'll fight amongst themselves over it. 5 or 10%. So that happens. It's a bit of a mixed bag. So it's all of that. There's been a big push too to sort of make the working class man not like unions or blame unions for things. Mm-hmm. A lot of advertising and marketing. There's certainly, you know, if you hear of a group, again, this is more my opinion, I think, than other things. But you know, if you have a group that has the title workers' rights in it, it's probably anti-union and it's probably not workers' rights.
Really? Okay. I mean, you know, as a student of history, right? You know, and the unions were founded and started to grow in the early part of the 20th century.
Right.
The concept being their strength in numbers, and we need to be treated fairly, right? And thus minimum wage ultimately came, and so on and so forth. So it's
correct.
I would think that employees, and we're not talking about CEOs and CFOs, obviously, but employees, the regular working Joes, might appreciate the benefits that unions can offer.
Right. Well, and you would think so, right? And so you would think people would want to do that, but the unions don't necessarily do sometimes the best marketing, or they're up against forces that have a lot of funds that are trying to break unions. It is kind of difficult to get a union. You have to go through a voting process. It has to be certified by the national, what's called the National Labor Relations Board. It's an entire process. The way it's set up, there are very few ways that you can actually get a union to get through into the workforce. But there's, you know, it's like trying a case, right? There's a million ways to kill a case, and there's only a few ways to win it.
Well, what should I be aware of? Let's say, you know, I'm an electrical union, whatever, you know, here in Baltimore, pick a place.
Sure.
And I've been hired by a local commercial electrical company. Once I'm hired, I'm presented, I guess, with some information about whatever the union is, whatever it's called. What should I be looking out for in terms of what benefits I can get and what concerns I might have in terms of being a member of that union?
The good thing about unions are they will put money away from your paycheck and will have management contribute to funds. And these funds could be a healthcare fund. If you get hurt, they'll have a retirement fund, you know, which usually is in the form of some sort of pension, and the unions will invest that. So as far as that sort of funding and benefits that will happen, that can be very useful for somebody. It's a long-term game. You have to be thinking long-term. So you can't be, you know, often young people don't, the nature of being young, you're not thinking about what's going to happen to you when you're 65 or 70, right?
That's for sure.
When you're 22. So that would be something, you know, so it's long-term. So that's what they should be looking out for. What's really important with the union, and you actually said this earlier, which is you use the word fair, right? So unlike for a lot of people in the workforce, unions are really, at the end of the day, it's about what's fair. And so, like, for instance, let's say you had a guy who worked at a company for 20 years, right? And he really partied it up on a Tuesday night, and he showed up Wednesday to work and he's drunk, right? If you were at a regular job, boss probably fires you. Doesn't matter. You were there 20 years, right? But if you have a union, the guy, you know, management says he's fired. Then you, as a union person, you would say, you know what? I don't think this is fair. I mean, yeah, I screwed up. All right, I screwed up, showed up drunk, but I've been working this place 20 years and I've been a great employee. Goes down to the union hall, talks to the union representative, and that kicks this process in called the grievance process.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll explain to you there's generally 4 to 5 steps of a grievance process. The first step is the union rep will meet with the manager and that decided to fire him. And that's usually the person at the lower level of the management. And that union rep either will meet with the employee or without the employee, and they'll just try to work it out and come up with, let's say, some sort of lesser discipline based upon the example that we have now, like maybe a 2-week suspension without pay or, you know, a dock of pay or something of that nature, not fired. If that process doesn't work, then usually it goes to what would be called a step 2 grievance. And that means that then they would meet with a person over the lower level manager. It's some sort of higher siting official. Maybe it's the director of human resources, or it could be the director of the department. And then they try to work it out there. Again, it's more informal. They talk it out. Okay, let's say they don't work it out there. Then they might go, and this is possibly where you lawyers will get involved, a lawyer for the union and a lawyer for management. They may go to an internal process where then they got to go in front of a panel, and they'll pick one person from the union and one from management, and then some neutral person from something else. And they decide internally, and they'll present evidence as to, you know, this guy's been here, his boss really likes him, he's been here 20 years. And then they'll say, well, wait a second, you know, he was drunk. He actually drank one other time, but I didn't write him up. There might, you know, it might be all that sort of evidence. And then that panel would decide. If that doesn't work, then you generally go to what's called arbitration. That's like a whole nother game. The arbitration is to replace fighting stuff in court. That's essentially what it does. And so that you have an outside party of some kind that's picked by union and management to go and decide what's going to happen to that employee. And that could be a panel, or that, like, in other words, you know, more than one person, or it could be just one person that they both agree upon. And then that's like a full trial. And the arbitrators, as they're called from the arbitration, they act like judges. And they'll have multiple days of evidence. They'll keep a record. They'll type it up. You know, there'll be closing arguments. There'll be briefs filed by the attorneys. So that works a lot like a court. And then what the arbitrator decides there generally is final. They're only like, you can go to court and try to have arbitration overruled. As someone who has tried to do that on occasion, courts absolutely hate when you show up with that, because the whole point of arbitration is to not be in court. So mm-hmm. The judges don't want to see that. And your ability to overturn an arbitrator's decision is very limited. You know, you have to show that they, like, absolutely blew it on the law. They didn't follow the law at all. And it's got to be not just like a judgment decision. It has to be they, like, didn't follow the law. Okay. And very clear. Or you'd have to show maybe that you can never show this. You have to show fraud or some sort of like a kickback to the arbitrator, which never happens. Those sorts of things. Otherwise, you're stuck with it. And so that's sort of the process for how, if you have a union, you know, you have all this fairness and all these rights. I was talking a lot about fairness there. If you don't have a union, then that, you know, we'll talk about that a little later. Fairness isn't really necessarily playing a role.
So let me ask you about this. So first we talked about folks who have employment contracts. Well, I have a contract with my employer. This process that you just laid out, that's pursuant to a contract between whom?
That's a contract between the union and management, and that's called the collective bargaining agreement, or people love to make acronyms, the CBA. So you'll hear people talk about the CBA, and that is a process where the union and management get together. It's usually every 3 to 5 years, and they negotiate a contract about literally everything that's going to take place in the workforce, and that will talk about employees' wages. It will talk about how you can discipline them. It will have the for cause that we just talked about earlier. You would be committing malpractice as a union if you didn't have at least a cause. So for cause in there, reason for people to be terminated or disciplined. A key thing is also something called progressive discipline, which means that you don't necessarily get terminated right out of the box for one infraction. Usually they have to do steps. So in other words, maybe you get a warning, you get oral counseling, you get suspended for a week, then you get fired. Now, if you committed a really bad infraction, you could get fired right out of the box. Like you bring a gun to work, like that would be an example. Yeah. Right? They can fire you right away for that. But you know, generally, if you screw up, have something go wrong, then you have this progressive discipline. That'll set that all out. The other really important thing that it does is it sets up like a scale, like a pay scale. It's similar. You might see this with the government too. If you work for the government, there's different scales. And people, at least in this area, know about the GS scale. That'll happen at the union. So what that means is you look at somebody and you say, all right, they're an electrical worker. That's what they do. All right, they've been here X amount of years and they've gotten X amount of rating from their performance evaluation, which is like their yearly, what their boss thinks they do year to year. So if they've got a good evaluation and they've been here for 5 years, you know, they'll make X amount of pay. And that sets up across the board how everybody gets paid. And that way, then again, this is fairness, right? So if you've been there for a certain period of time, it shouldn't matter anything else about you, and you're doing a good job, you get paid the same amount as the guy down the hall or the woman down the hall, you know, whether they have red hair or, you know, dye their hair or whatever they're doing, they're just doing electrical work. And so that's the situation. So that also sets that up in the collective bargaining agreement, and that is all in there. It will also talk about your pension and how, you know, what percentages have to be funded by the employer and what percentage by the employee. I will talk about the ability, you know, often in the construction industry, the electrical worker we have, those jobs are not permanent. You don't stay at a job site if you're a construction employee forever. You know, once the building is built, after a year or two, you got to move on to the next one. So that will literally spell out who gets a job and when they get the job. It's a term called, you know, seniority. So who's ever most senior will go through. So if the business needs 30 employees to go build the next building that they're doing, then they'll look at who are the 30 most senior people. They will probably get first dibs, and they can decide whether they want to take it or not. If they decide not to take it, it'll move to the next person on the list, the seniority. So these are all the sorts of possibilities that can happen from a collective bargaining agreement. So there's a lot of rights there. If you're an employee, you should, you know, try to understand those. Sometimes the agreement itself is kind of dense for people. It's something, you know, that attorneys wrote. There'll be a guide that you might have that the union can hand you to sort of give you an understanding of that. That's generally how that process works.
So if I'm in a union employee and I'm looking at this manual that's, you know, a foot and a half thick, and I want to try to understand what could happen if something occurs at the workplace and I can't figure it out, I should have a union rep or someone I can go ask that question of.
That is absolutely correct. Yeah, you go to your union rep. Now, if your union rep isn't any good, and I often tell people this, then you go to your vice president of the union. And let me just tell you, vice presidents of unions don't usually like to be bothered by the members. So if you go do that, that generally puts a lot of heat on the union rep, and it usually works itself out.
Okay.
But sometimes it doesn't. But that's sort of more of a practical situation.
All right. So first block of folks are people who have the individual employment contracts. Second block of people we talked about, small, this 12% roughly, are unionized and work through whatever contract that's been negotiated by their union with the employer. And then we have the rest of us, right?
Yeah, the rest of us.
Talk about the rest of us.
So the rest of us are what's called at-will employees. And people may or may not have heard of that term. But if you have heard of that term, then the phrase that always comes out is, if you're an at-will employee, which is 80-something percent of us, you can be fired for a good reason, such as you stole from the company, fired. A bad reason, the employer thought you stole from the company, but you didn't steal from the company. It was actually somebody else. It's a bad reason, you're still fired. or frankly, no reason at all. They just fire you. So that is employment at will. Now, if you're an employee at will, that doesn't mean you don't have any rights, you know, and I'll explain sort of what your rights are. These are generally by statute, or they've been created by a court, mostly by statute or some sort of code. And if you have a contract, an employment contract, or you're a member of a union, you also have generally almost all of these rights that I'm going to talk to you about. There's on occasion the collective bargaining agreement may, or the contract may take care of a right or two here, but generally that doesn't happen very often. So the first thing, which I think probably most people know about and probably have either seen in the news or at least heard about, is discrimination. And that is to make an employment decision for an employee or against the employee based upon some sort of, you know, generally inherent characteristic. And what is that? So that's your race, that's your gender. That's recently, according, you know, under federal law, the Supreme Court said that sexual orientation, national origin, and religion. That law came into effect in 1964 under the Civil Rights Act of 1964 in Title VII. And Title VII set the floor, which is the minimum rights, because it's the federal law, for discrimination. Now, states and local governments are allowed to pass laws that give more rights to employees. You know, for years, it was thought that Title VII didn't, for instance, cover sexual orientation. And so states and localities would pass laws saying you can't fire somebody for being, you know, gay or transgender or something of that, something within the sexual orientation realm.
But how isn't this difficult to prove in certain circumstances? So, you know, again, let's find another example. Now, instead of being an employee, I'm the employer and I'm hiring someone to be a lawyer in my law firm.
Okay.
Let's go with that.
Yep.
And I've got five candidates. Four are white, one is black. I don't like black people, but the candidates are equal on paper. Who's going to know if I decide I'm not hiring this person because he's African American? How do you prove that?
Yeah. So hiring situations are really, really tough because the person isn't in the actual workplace, right? So yeah. that is a really tough example that you just gave to prove. The way you would prove it is you would, you know, first you got to get a lawyer and the lawyer's got to go in and you'd have to show it the workforce. Like if in your example, the employer doesn't like black people, probably hasn't hired any or not many. And right. So you say, look, here's the population. The population is X and, you know, a quarter of the population or 15% of the population is black. And this company has hired, you know, two black people. They have 150 employees in 30 years. Okay. And you would try to prove it that way. Also, as you do things within, as a lawyer, you take, you know, depositions, you put people under oath. That employer has probably said something to that effect at some point to somebody. On occasion, you know, as someone who does this work, you get lucky and somebody puts something in an email or something like that. And you just got to build it up generally from circumstantial evidence with a little bit of statements and other written things that people have said. It is not easy under the example you gave.
So I kind of want to modify my example a little bit. Now let's toggle over to a religious organization and I have a dozen employees and I'm a faith-based company. You know, we provide literature to, I mean, pick any religious group, to a Christian group. And that's what we do. We collect articles, we provide literature, and we're a very conservative organization. And that's what we do. And I find out that one of my employees is a homosexual. And that doesn't fit for us. It doesn't fit what we want to be. It doesn't fit for what we look like. And therefore, I can't have that individual working for me anymore, and I fire him or her.
Right.
So now what?
So that generally would be a discrimination suit. Now, there are exceptions that would occur for religion. Religion is an interesting sort of animal.
That's why I ask you about it.
Yeah, I know you did. Yeah, it's good. Like it's like a law school exam question. It was very good. So the person, if the person's job duties are not inherently religious, this is sort of in layman's terms how the courts look at this. In other words, meaning it's not your pastor, maybe the head of the choir, or like someone that's doing an inherently religious duty, then you can't do that if there's a statute or law that prohibits well, that now it's countrywide because of Title VII and the Supreme Court, but prohibits sexual orientation discrimination. So if that person's literally walking around passing out flyers, that's not really an inherently religious duty. Now, if they're leading the flock, right, that is an inherently religious duty. And so you would be able to make that argument. So there is an exception for religious duties, but, and, you know, and this, there's a spectrum, right? So in courts fall all over the spectrum on this. It's actually a, it's a kind of a, you hit sort of more of a hot topic. Courts are falling different, you know, is the guy that runs the choir, is that inherently religious? I mean, they're singing songs, but really it's about singing. So, you know, and some courts say it is, and some courts say it isn't. I'd love to give you a real bright line rule on that and say, this is what happens in those situations. But that has been sort of all over the map. And I think, you know, until there's, frankly, it may never actually completely work itself out on that example. But that's a tough question. Yeah, that'll happen. And that would probably end up in a court and someone's going to have to make a call.
But in those cases, it could vary, right? With the results or whether it falls in the discrimination bucket could vary, whether it's in Maryland or South Carolina or Texas or wherever, I guess, depending upon the laws in those particular states.
That is absolutely correct. So some localities have and states have more protections. And I'll give you an example. So a lot of people are shocked by this. So I have people, sometimes they'll tell me, and I don't understand why a boss would do this, but some people are, you know, sometimes you get a crazy boss. So the boss walks into work one day and he says, you know what? I just don't want any red-haired people working here. And he fires everybody with red hair. Or he decides, you know what? If you're obese, I'm not having you work here. It has nothing to do with the job. I'm just not having you work here because I just don't like people that are obese. And people are like, think, well, that's got to be illegal, right? Well, no, not necessarily. And I would say, like your example, South Carolina, that would not be illegal. In Maryland, however, a lot of the counties, for instance, have what's called physical appearance discrimination. And so having red hair or having obesity would be covered under their physical appearance. But in a place like South Carolina, they don't have that. Now, under my example that I just gave to you, if you work in South Carolina and the guy comes in and he says this is what's known as a something plus case. And what that means is, guy comes in and says, I'm just firing redheads that are female. Well, now you have a sex discrimination case. It's plus that in characteristic. You really, the essence of that decision is, I don't want women with red hair to work here. So that would be how sometimes those cases come in. But if you don't have a state or local law that, for instance, has physical appearance, you could fire people for that. That would be under my example, as I said, of at will, of a bad reason to fire somebody. I mean, most people would generally agree.
But okay, so I hate to keep asking these kind of questions, but in terms of real life practice, you know, say I open a restaurant, and my restaurant is all my waiters are former athletes, and they're going to be in good shape, big. They're athletes. They wear their football jerseys, or they wear their basketball jersey, or soccer, or whatever it might be. But these are athletic guys, and people come there. They watch sports on the TV. They talk to guys who used to play sports, and so on and so forth, or women, or whomever, for that matter. So someone shows up on my doorstep applying for a job who, you know, weighs 600 pounds. This is an extreme example, but doesn't fit the profile of what I'm putting out as far as what I want my place to look like and feel like when customers come. So if I don't hire that person, I've discriminated against them and I'm subject to being sued.
So you would have a under that physical appearance that I gave you an example. And by the way, as you know this, David, anybody can file a lawsuit. So you probably would get sued. Now, whether it has any merit to it or
right,
not.
Right, yeah, yeah. That was a bad way of asking
the
question.
So you definitely know that. But under your example, you would have a defense saying, look, this is what we do. We need someone that has sports connections. So we didn't hire, you know, and that has a certain ability to interact with the people and know about sports. And this guy doesn't have it. He doesn't meet the bill. He's not able to handle what we're looking for. And so we didn't hire him. Now, again, under your example, you might have linemen, right, that maybe were really good in college and let themselves go, right? Let's say you had a guy that was overweight because he just, you know, he gave up, right?
Sure.
He's not working out like he used to in college. And so if you let him, if you just decided not to hire that guy because of his weight, then you would have a problem. You know, I thought what you were going to say, which is interesting, because there were examples given when that statute was first passed in the 60s, where people would say, and this was generally done in the South, and it was against Black people. They would say, you know, I didn't hire this guy because he's black, but it wasn't me. I'm not racist. My clients are racist. You know, the people that come into my restaurant are terribly racist, and I can't hire a black person. And, you know, there was a whole back and forth about that at early stages, and the employers lost, basically. The courts all ruled, the EEOC, which is the agency, the Employment Opportunity Commission, Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, which is in charge of enforcing that statute. They all came out with guidance and regulations that said, if your clientele, your customers are discriminating and you let it happen to your employee, you are discriminating. Mm-hmm. So like another example would be, you know, you're running a bar and the guys are touching the waitresses and making sexual comments. You let that happen to your staff, then that's on you too. So you got to get rid of the customer. So that's another way. Otherwise the statutes, you know, could lose their teeth. They wouldn't have any enforcement. So that's another area where that can come up.
Now, is there any difference in rights if I'm a government employee versus me being a private? You know, I work for a private company.
Yeah, there's a ton of rights. if you're a government employee, there's an entire system that's set up to protect you, and there are limited reasons that you can be fired for that. There's an entire system that's been set up for enforcing, for instance, discrimination. Laws. You don't even go through the EEOC, but you don't even go through the same process as private employers. It would take me like an hour and a half to explain probably all of the rights.
We'll have you come back and do that one.
I could do that one. Yeah.
All right.
You know, there's some basic constitutional rights that you have against a government employer that you wouldn't have against a private employer. Like, you know, you have, for instance, the right to free speech, which is, you know, protected from the government. So when people say, you know, I have a First Amendment right or a free speech right, they'll often hear somebody say that. And they have a fundamental misunderstanding of what that means. That's the government that can't stop you from saying what you want. But your boss could do that. So I've actually had people call me up and say, you know what, I told the boss to, you know, F off. And I know I've got a First Amendment right. And I'm like, do you work for the government? And they're like, no. I'm like, well, you don't. You know, they can fire you for that. So you kind of have to, you know, be careful with what your rights are. But that would be an example.
Didn't this come up a little bit a couple of years ago when you had the quarterback from the 49ers, right? The San Francisco 49ers. And he was kneeling for the national anthem and ultimately got cut, right? And hasn't been, apparently, you know, was having a decent, if not stellar career, but having a pretty good career as a quarterback, and then couldn't even get a tryout from other professional football teams. And there was some question, I think, at the time, whether that was a free speech right.
Right.
And so, we could have seven of these sessions. I don't want to go too far into this, but tell us a little bit about that and why was that club able to just cut him loose, primarily because they didn't like him kneeling during the national anthem?
So that, from the standpoint, because that was a little more complicated because there's race issues involved.
Yeah.
And so from the standpoint of free speech, he had pretty much zero rights. So he can do whatever he wants. If he were, let's say he was protesting something and it didn't have any of the racial, you know, the politics and the race part of that, he wouldn't have a right. Your employer can tell you, look, you can believe whatever you want. You can think what you want, but not on my time. Okay. And because they're private employers and they don't have to hire somebody like that. Now, did he have the potential? He never took a case, right? He never went forward on one that I'm aware of. The potential to argue that, well, actually why you did it isn't just because I was speaking my mind. You did it because I was speaking my mind about race. Well, that might be a race discrimination lawsuit. I don't believe he did press those. I don't think he sued on that. So again, you know, often things can be characterized under protections under certain laws like discrimination. And that would be a good example. You know, if he had wanted to go forward and Kaepernick had wanted to go forward and press that, he might have had a race claim. And so, and you know, frankly, that would have been just I thought it was a bit of a PR nightmare, depending on who your target groups are anyway, you know, but a lawsuit like that could be bad PR for an employer. They might just want to get rid of it. That's definitely a hot topic that could, you know, be falling into the discrimination bucket.
Gotcha. Well, Brian, we could, we got to have you back and drill down on some of these things. It sounds to me like five or six of these topics, we could certainly spend another half hour on each, just on each of them, talking about them separately. And you've done a great job today. We really appreciate you sort of giving a nice big smattering of information for all of us who are employees, from coast to coast. And we thank you for that. And we thank you for joining us today on JGL Law for You. Now, if anyone wants to reach out to you with an employment issue, what's the best way for them to get hold of you?
Sure. They can call me at 240-553-1207. That's 240-553-1207. Or they can email me at bmarkovitz, which is B and then M-A-R-K-O-V. That's V as in Victor, I-T-Z, at jgllaw.com. There's two L's in the middle there, jgllaw.com.
All right, Brian, again, thanks so much. This was great. Thanks to everyone out there for listening in. We hope you join us for our next episode. I'm David Bullitt, and this is JGL Law for You.